Accession number 19040, real one.
Major Duckworth, real one, where were you born, please?
In Calcutta.
Which year was this?
1923.
Were you born in Calcutta because your father was Indian Army?
No, my father was a consultant engineer for Marshalls, the tea plantation engineers, etc.
And did you have your upbringing and education in England or in India?
Oh, in England.
Whereabouts?
I came home when I was two. And then we stayed in England thereafter.
Whereabouts?
In Spalding, mainly, in Lincolnshire.
And where did you have your schooling?
Initially at the Spalding Grammar School, and then went off to the Royal Masonic School in Bushey.
And when did you join the army?
On the 10th of December, 1941. The day the Prince of Wales was sunk.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Indeed, yes.
Under what circumstances?
Listening to the wireless.
In Spalding?
Yes.
What were your feelings about that?
I think we had reached a stage which I thought was inevitable and had thought for some time. Both my brothers had joined the Territorial Army, and we had French visitors with whom my eldest brother had au paired for language purposes. The elder of the two had quite recently left us, and the year before he'd been terribly gloomy about the prospects. And having talked at length with him, I also felt the same. I was about 15 at the time, but it seemed to me there was an inevitability that war was coming. And so it was no surprise, really.
Did the war affect you at first, before you joined the army?
Only in so far as my brothers were obviously instantly called up with the territorials, and one of them went straight to France in, I suppose, November or thereabouts in 1940.
So you didn't experience any of the bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Well, not at that stage. We didn't have any bombs in Lincolnshire until, I would have thought, the autumn to winter of the following year, when we did have some bombs round about Spalding. And I can remember one night being out. I joined the LDV with local defence volunteers, and I was out in the town, and I can't think what I was actually doing, but I can remember suddenly the air raid sirens, and then very shortly afterwards, the bombs coming closer, and great string of them coming closer and closer. And I can remember lying in the, which was a foolish place, lying in the porchway of a shop with all the glass windows round about. And I can't say I was frightened at that time, because I looked round and I saw somebody there, and I thought, oh, poor chap, he's frightened.
Whereabouts in Spalding did the bombs hit?
All around the edge, rather.
Do you remember the names of any streets or buildings?
I can picture it, but I can't remember the name.
Were there any casualties?
Yes, there was one, only one as far as I know, and it was a chap I'd known from a lot of my life, and he was on a bicycle, and I think he received almost a direct hit.
And which month and year would this have been?
I can't remember. I think it was round about October or November 1940, but I can't be sure of that now.
Can you tell me anything about the Spalding LDV?
No, we all joined up, as many of us as were there. I had a very great friend who was an absolute soulmate, and we went along together, and we used to do our guards together on the vulnerable points, the gasworks mainly, and we paraded, and one, obviously with the arrogance of youth, was fairly disdainful of the elder brethren, who many of whom had been in the First World War, but whom we thought were out of date. But now, with hindsight, one realizes that they weren't quite as old and fuddy-duddy as one thought.
Did you all have rifles?
Yes, we all had a... I think we had Enfields, but I can't be sure. I think it was an Enfield we had.
Did you get much training with this unit?
Not a lot, no, because there was a certain amount of weapon training, but not really. But my recollection of it was that we went to joined up and then did guard duties, and that was about that, and wore an armband with LDV on it. But I can't recollect doing much training.
Did you personally think that the Germans would invade?
Oh, yes, I think it seemed, again, almost inevitable.
What kind of an account of themselves would the Spalding LDV have given?
I think that's a question which no one can really answer. And knowing now, that one didn't know then, the ferocity of modern war and the weapons they could bring to bear, we would have been brushed aside with absolutely no difficulty at all.
Can you tell me about going into the army on the 10th of December 41, please?
Yes, I arrived at King's Cross station to be horrified to read the placards saying Prince of Wales and Repulse sunk, which seemed unbelievable by, of all people, the Japanese. And then I got on the train at Waterloo and went down to the Bovington camp in Dorset. It was a really foul, wet night. And we were piled into the back of a 3-ton truck and driven from Wool Station to Stanley Barracks, which then housed the 58th Young Soldiers Training Regiment, RAC. Everybody in the regiment was a volunteer pre-military age. And it was Stanley Barracks, and curiously enough, in subsequent times, it became the junior leaders' barracks for the Armoured Corps. That it was a marvellous regiment to be with, tremendous spirit. Of course, everybody a volunteer. And the idea, I think, was that it, rather like its successor, the junior leaders' regiment, was to provide officers and NCOs for the Armoured Corps.
What happened to you next?
What happened?
What happened to you next?
Well, I applied for a commission, and I went through the usual processes of the regimental selection, and then the RCB, which was not RCB, sorry, WASBE, War Office Selection Board, and then eventually was sent to, well, it became a lance corporal, what they call the much despised PULC, Provisional Unpaid Lance Corporal, for about, I think probably about 2 months. And then was sent to Blackdown, where they had a pre-octu. And at the pre-octu, you did almost a repeat course of what one had done at Bovington. At Bovington, you did phase training, the square, driving and maintenance month, gunnery a month, wireless a month, and collective training a month, more or less in that order. And each time one went through training with the Armoured Corps, that process was repeated, and we'd started on doing the same thing at Blackdown, but had got only, I think, at the, as the end of the initial stage, when we were called forward to Sandhurst. It all depended on the vacancies. There was an element of chance of how long you spent with the pre-octu. Didn't seem to me that you had a prescribed length of time there. And so then I went to Sandhurst, where we went through exactly the same format, the initial general military training for a month, driving and maintenance for a month, gunnery for a month, and so on, and collective training at the end, after which you passed out and went to your regiment as a trained troop leader. But then that's really when one's training really started.
Which regiment did you want to go to?
Well, I went initially to a wartime regiment, which I was invited to join at Sandhurst, called the 22nd Dragoons, which was a very high-class regiment. And it was formed from a cadre of officers and NCOs drawn from the 4th, 7th Royal Dragoon Guards and the 5th Royal Inniskilling Dragoon Guards. And we trained up in Yorkshire and then came down to Warminster, where we did a lot of exercises on Salisbury Plain.
Whereabouts in Yorkshire were they?
Helmsley, Duncan Park, which is still regarded as the spiritual home of the 22nd Dragoons. And in fact, in 1995, they had a reunion there. Their last, what they said would be the last central reunion, because everybody's getting so old and fewer and fewer. But I think we had something like 276 old comrades and wives and families there, which was a great turnout.
What were they equipped with in 1942?
Covenanters, which was a fast, light, called a cruiser tank. It never went into action. It was very light-skinned, had a two-pounder gun, a Christie suspension, and that was it, really. And it was superseded by the Crusader, though we never had the Crusader, which actually did fight in the desert. We eventually went on to a tank called the Centaur, which was the precursor of the Cromwell. The Centaur never went to war, as far as I know.
And you tell me you went to a Salisbury plane for training?
Yes, but we were stationed in Warminster.
Any memories of that training?
Days careering across Salisbury Plain, weeks out. Sometimes at the camp, we did a camp at Studland Bay, where the Noel House Hotel, which is still in existence and flourishing, was commandeered as our officers' mess. But the beaches and all the coastline was mined and wired, so we didn't get down to the beach. But we did quite a bit of training on Studland Bay and a bit of firing at Lulworth, which has been the gunnery school for the Royal Armoured Corps for ages.
And what was your role at this time?
I was just a tank group leader.
And the next step?
Well, we then we trained for a while there, and then suddenly they decided we were going to convert to be what they call funnies, and the regiment was turned into a flail regiment.
Can you tell me about this equipment, please?
To do that, we joined General Hobart's 79th Armored Division. And the flail tank, called a Crab, nicknamed or codenamed Crab, was a Sherman tank with a gantry on the front, with a roller and a number of chains with weights on the end, which rotated at great speed, beating the ground in front of you as you went. And that exploded the mines. And our role was to clear minefields from the beaches onwards. And we had extensive training doing that. First of all, at Stow-on-the-Wold, where we moved to, and completely destroyed their golf course, which was never recovered. And then we moved to Suffolk, where we did a little bit more sort of coastal work. And then the regiment moved on to the south coast prior to the invasion. And then landed and worked with various different formations. Never together, really. The squadrons were always separated, and sometimes troops. And they went on doing that until the end of the war. But I left them in Normandy to go to the Skins, the 5th Royal Enniskillen Dragoon Guards.
What did you and your brother officers, and the men for that matter, feel about this equipment that you'd been issued with the Crabs?
Well, I think we were all very disappointed to have lost our normal armoured role. It seemed to be a downgrading of our ambitions, as it were. But people got reconciled to it. But that, I think it wasn't really quite the same as normal, it certainly wasn't the same as normal armoured warfare. And I gather that sometime later after the Rhine crossing, they cast off their gantries and did operate in North Holland, I think, in part of North Germany, as an ordinary armoured regiment.
What were the problems of operating flail tanks?
I think principally you had to produce a path through a minefield, and the way they did it is that you had a leading tank, which was followed by number two, which should go exactly in the tracks, not overlapping, but just one track following the other, and so echelon back. So you had three tanks forming a broad sweep through a minefield. And I think the main problems were keep maintaining station and doing what one needed to do for self-protection.
Were there any tricks for maintaining station?
Well, we did have, I can't remember them ever being used. During training, when we were doing it night, all night training, we had on the side of each tank, on the offside, two lights on post, and you had to keep those in line. But I don't remember that ever being used. I think the worst sort of problems were probably the dust, smoke, and so on, probably dark as well, light as well, or lack of it. But I think generally, I can't speak very much. I didn't stay them long there, but I think the general form was that it's the fog of war and the heat of battle was the main problems.
And the second problem you said was self-protection, did you say?
Well, yes, they had a gun. I mean, they had a 75mm gun and machine guns and so on.
And which troop and squadron were you personally in when Normandy came?
I was initially a B squadron.
And the troop?
4th troop. But then I left that to become, to command the reinforcement squadron, half squadron. And so that's why I missed that lot. And then eventually I went off, a person I admired enormously had been a skin and a squadron leader in the 22nd Dragoons, had gone back to the skins. And through him, I followed and joined the skins.
When you landed in Normandy, was that on D-Day or
no? I was at D+3.
Can you tell me what the crossing and the landing was like, please?
Well, yes, it was still fairly rough, and we landed virtually dry shod. We waded a very slight bit, and that was about all, really.
Which beach was this?
Juneau.
So that was a Canadian beach?
That's right. We were supporting the Canadian.
Was there any enemy fire?
Not that encountered shelling. Only.
What time of day did you land?
Quite early, if I remember rightly. I would have said it was round about 8 o'clock-ish. I don't know. I'm a bit vague. It was early. I mean, I can't give the exact time.
And once you'd landed, what was the state of the beaches?
Well, they were fairly crowded. There were lots of stuff, lots of kid around, all coming in.
And then once you'd landed, what did you do?
Well, we went to a place called San Gabriel, a little village.
What happened there?
Well, we stayed there for a bit, and then we fed forward tanks which were required for replacements and so on. And that was all we did then.
Were you in any fighting with the 22nd Dragoons in Normandy?
No, my first real thing was with the 7th Armored Division. I joined 7th Armored Division. And on my way through, was sidetracked to divisional headquarters, and I had a great friend who was with me at the time, and we were assigned liaison officers in the first stage before we went forward to the skins, and we had various experiences in Normandy, which. So it coincided from time to time, but because we joined up or branched away from a particular thing, going to regiments like the 11th Hussars or the initially the County of London Yeomanry, and such things as that, really. And then we eventually were fed forward and joined the skins.
What stage had the battle for Normandy reached by the time you joined the skins?
Just coming to the end. I went there at Saint-Georges, joined them actually, but remained with the 7th Armored Division headquarters until we'd finished the Swan to Malines, from the Seine to Malines, really. And I actually joined them at Malines, or just before Malines.
What role did you have with them when you joined them?
Well, initially I was headquarter troop leader, RHQ troop leader. And then a lovely man called Wilfred Crocker, whose father was a corps commander, was killed in the reconnaissance squadron. And this former 22nd Dragoon officer who I joined the skins for, as it were, was commanding the recce squadron, so I went and said, could I come join him? And so I was joined up with the recce squadron and went on from there.
What was your friend's name?
My friend, John. Well, he was known as Robert Crockett, but his real name is John Crockett. But when he joined the regiment in 1936, there were a number of Johns in the regiment, and when he said to the adjutant his name was John, the adjutant said, "Well, have you another name?" He said, "Yes, Robert." "Well, you're Robert from now on." So throughout his army career, he was Robert Crockett. Marvellous man he was too.
And what equipment did you have in the recce unit?
Initially, we had a General Stuart tank known as a Honey, a Bren carrier, and a Daimler scout car called a Dingo.
Was it called the recce squadron?
It was called the recce squadron. In most regiments, it was a recce troop, but they decided to form it into a squadron with, at one stage, three troops, another stage, four troops, to give it, I think, greater flexibility. And they had an officer in charge of each troop, which was probably a better arrangement than happened in other regiments, where they had one officer, one recce troop commander, possibly an officer second in command, and then all the vehicles in, I don't know how they operate, but I suppose in small patrols. But we seem to have a very good way of working, and we're perhaps unique in that.
And you joined the recce squadron in Belgium, did you?
At the end of September, I think it was.
Can you tell me of your experiences with the recce squadron, please?
Well, they're difficult because you spend a lot of time, what you might call, encountering nothing. That you go on probing here and there. I found that the scout car wasn't really of great use because its cross-country performance was negligible. You know, if, for instance, trying to get off a road across a ditch and things like that would almost inevitably mean you'd get bogged. But we spent a certain amount of time on our feet because one reached stages where it was advisable probably to have a little look on your feet quietly rather than motor forward. However silently they said a Daimler could move, it still made a fairly distinctive noise, whereas if you were on your feet, you were making much less noise.
And should you find anything worth reporting, how was it done?
Well, I either went back to the vehicle, and initially again the scout car, because I dispensed with the scout car eventually, but initially to the scout car, and then made a report. Or, if it was possible, summoned up the Bren carrier, which my troop corporal commanded, because we kept in visual touch, obviously. You don't lose touch. It's between front and rear, always, you've got touch. And so if the position looked as if it could come forward, I would wave the